It is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This is an abuse of power. One individual should not be able to unilaterally obstruct the swearing in of a duly elected member of Congress for political reasons.
There's nobody here that can define what the Epstein Files is, not even myself. I don't know what the Epstein Files are, but what I'm in favor of is releasing and being transparent with all the documentation that they have that they can release.
A Colorado River future that puts all the cuts on Arizona, that the Upper Basin doesn't take any cuts, is not acceptable. And we've made that clear.
There's also a tendency, I think, as time wears on, at least based on my past experience, that the bar is lowered as time goes on and the willingness to accept compromises that really are not in the best interest of the river and declare victory when it's really not, then becomes a problem.
This president doesn't care about them, and he wanted to give a big giant tax cut to the wealthiest Americans and pay for it by jacking up people's health care costs.
I think it's another message to Chris Mays to move on. I think at this point, if she doesn't move on, it's going to cost her politically. I think everybody's tired of it.
And joining me to talk about the swearing in of Arizona's newest member of Congress, the end of the federal government shutdown, and more are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So, Sam, the Arizona's congressional delegation is now whole after Adelita Grijalva went from representative-elect to representative after, I don't know, a little bit of time, a minute or so had passed since she was actually elected. Obviously, this doesn't really change the balance of power in Congress, but does it make things maybe a little more dicey for House Speaker Mike Johnson now that the Democratic caucus has one more member in it?
I mean, I think that the math is the math. You know, the tight window that Speaker Johnson had on any vote that he put up now is formally one vote tighter with the very, very close margin in Congress. But I think more than anything, I think that Arizona now, to your point, does have a whole congressional delegation, no longer Congresswoman-elect, but Congresswoman Grijalva, and really excited to see, you know, some of the policies that she put forth during the campaign. She's now actually going to be able to extrapolate into policy ideas and really kind of share the personnel that she's bringing into the office, and excited to kind of move beyond this spectacle and drama of not being sworn in. And she's formally signed the discharge petition, so we can perhaps even move on from that story and really see what Congresswoman Grijalva is going to bring to Congress.
Lorna, does it obviously, as I said, it doesn't change the balance of power. She replaced her dad, who is, of course, also a Democrat. But do you think it changes anything in the House?
No, not really. I mean, the House has been a dramatic place for quite a while, even before, Congressman Grijalva passed away and this re-election to or this election to replace him. So I don't think the dynamics shift. Right. Yes. Now the Arizona congressional delegation is whole. The Democrats have their numbers in D.C., but the same dynamics still exist between Republicans and Democrats, even amongst Republicans in Congress, too. I mean, there's a lot of Republican infighting that Speaker Johnson always has to deal with. So this really doesn't change the game whatsoever.
So we were talking before we went on about sort of the dynamic of Representative Grijalva, and we heard Representative Stanton as well just a few moments ago in the well of the House speaking right after Grijalva was sworn in, and not saying super nice things about House Speaker Mike Johnson when he was like 5 feet behind her standing at this on the dais there. We couldn't see his face. The feed I was watching on C-SPAN, you couldn't see his face. But it was just kind of striking as somebody who's not in politics that, like, they're going after this guy and he was right there.
Yeah. It just goes to show that obviously there's just not a lot of common courtesy in D.C. anymore. Right? I mean, we're used to seeing these fights on social media or on Twitter or campaign emails for fundraising and whatnot. Now people are just attacking each other to each other's faces over, you know, things that are pretty minor. And I think, honestly, to Speaker Johnson's credit, he gets criticized from the right and left every single day. So I think that was no sweat off his back. He probably tuned it out, in all honesty, when it was happening.
Think he wasn't maybe he was maybe checking his phone or something.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the to the point that Lorna was saying about the decorum, we really are missing that in real life now. It used to be just on social media and these kind of distant jabs. And we're seeing, you know, members of Congress kind of, you know, just follow leaders down the hall to try to corner them into answering things. So I wasn't surprised to see kind of that forceful rhetoric in the well of the House, but somewhat disappointing to see for you know, those of us who kind of like the decorum of the institution.
Yeah. Lorna, Sam mentioned the discharge petition that Representative Grijalva signed right after she finished her speech, meaning the House will take up a vote on whether or not to release the Epstein files. Mm-hmm. We heard from Congressman Biggs in the montage saying that he would vote in favor of that. Is that surprising to you at all, especially given how close he is with President Trump and how much we know President Trump does not want that to happen?
No, I'm not surprised by it, just for the simple fact. I mean, there's so many people on the far right Republican online circles that have just been obsessed over these Epstein files for years, right? And it's really become an issue for Republicans of how can you defend something when you're not being fully transparent, especially when there were so many promises made in the past about being transparent about this issue. Get it off the table. Release the files. Get it out there. There's still going to be a group of people who are conspiracy theorists that are just going to say, this isn't everything, or they're still covering it up. That's still going to exist. But to have it be almost a daily media headline and just something that people are going to constantly have to address going into the 2016 election is not helpful for Republicans. So just get it off the table, move on as much as you can, and honestly, hold the people accountable who need to be held accountable who are involved in this horrific situation.
Well, and Sam, I wonder, to Lorna's point, is it the kind of thing that Congressman Biggs and maybe Congressman Schweikert as well don't want to have to talk about in their runs for governor?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think both of them are going to be confronted with those questions because they're going to have that vote that is taken next week that they're going to have to answer to. I would expect that both of them will vote to do that, so that the question is more about how do we respond to the files rather than whether the files are going to be out. Because I think with Congresswoman Grijalva's swearing in and signing of the petition, that question is now put to bed. So now you're kind of seeing the shift in the rhetoric and shift in the dialogue that, you know, what do we do now that the information is out?
So, Sam, Congresswoman Grijalva was able to be sworn in because, according to Speaker Johnson, because the government reopened, right? The Senate and the House this week both voted to reopen the government. There's been a lot of criticism of Senate Democrats for brokering this agreement because they didn't end up getting what they said they were shutting the government down for, which is extended ACA healthcare subsidies for premiums that in Arizona have gone up, across the country have gone up by a lot, even without the subsidy going away. Do you join that criticism? Do you think Democrats got enough for their votes to reopen the government?
I think that it was an incredibly difficult situation, and I think it still is important to remind folks that there's a Republican in the president and there's a Republican control of the House and a Republican control of the U.S. Senate. Obviously, there needed to be some negotiation and compromise to get to 60 votes. That included 8 Democrats that were not either one of our 2 Senate Democrats that really held firm in their commitment to protecting the 24 million Americans that rely on these subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, and a significant number of those here in Arizona. So I think that to a large extent, we needed to end the charade, the specter of what the government shutdown was starting to do. There was real harm coming with the SNAP shutdowns that were coming. I think that Secretary Duffy from the Department of Transportation indicated that there was going to be massive air traffic disruptions that were on the precipice. So the government needed to open. I think it's unfortunate that the Democrats didn't get exactly what they wanted out of that. But I'm proud of our delegation, in particular Senator Gallego and Senator Kelly, for standing firm in making sure that we can provide consistency and affordability for those receiving health care from the Affordable Care Act.
So, Lorna, it sounds like there will be a vote sometime next month, early next month in the U.S. Senate, about whether or not to extend the subsidies. That seemed to be part of the deal the Democrats got for voting to reopen the government. Was not, as Leader Thune said, I can't promise you an outcome. I can promise you a process. How do you think that vote's going to go?
It'll be really interesting because now we're in this phase where folks are starting to see what the increase is going to be for the upcoming year for their health insurance premiums, right? And as you mentioned, they are skyrocketing. For folks who do rely on these premium tax credits, and then folks who don't, right? And so I think as that continues on and open enrollment increases, there's going to be more pressure on Congress to act, right? The question is now, Republicans, a lot of the commentary has been all these premium tax credits, what they're doing is just subsidizing insurers, right? It's not actually helping the individual. So there's a lot of conversation about that, about what's the actual value of it outside of just lowering the cost to the individual, but is it actually helping healthcare outcomes and access to affordable and quality health insurance? And so I think that's going to be the debate going leading up to it is how do they frame this moving forward? It doesn't fix Obamacare. It does not fix health insurance whatsoever. And honestly, these conversations should have been happening for a very long time in Congress. But to have that coupled with the federal shutdown and other issues that were emerging, like Sam mentioned, such as SNAP, and then, you know, the impacts to air travel going into the holidays, which was going to impact millions of Americans, some Democrats had to reprioritize. And I agree, they did not get everything that they wanted. And this was a deal that they could have done weeks ago and prevented a lot of this mishap that's happened.
Does – I mean, we talk so much about the issue of affordability in the elections, not so much in Arizona, but across the country from earlier this month. Does that continue, do you think, into next year? Like, do you anticipate that we're still going to be talking about affordability and specifically healthcare affordability going into the 2026 elections?
I do. I think Democrats are not going to let that issue go away by any means. So I do think it'll be discussed. I do think when you look at when you look at voter sentiment, a cost and affordability is number one, right? That's the top concern. And in that includes health insurance. And when folks are seeing that their premiums are increasing by 25-30%, and they have to make hard decisions of do we forego health insurance or do we get a lesser quality plan so we can continue to pay our mortgage or do that? Like, these are real conversations that people are happening. And I don't think that there's going to be much of a difference between now and then going into a primary a few months from now. That's still going to be top of mind because we're not solving any issues right now, and it's going to be the same problem going into open enrollment next year where people are going to see prices go back up.
So in general, over the past, let's say, decade since the Affordable Care Act went into effect, a little more than that now, typically, not always, but typically healthcare has been a better issue for Democrats than Republicans. Does that continue, do you think? Like, if Democrats are able to continue to make healthcare affordability, the Affordable Care Act, a major issue that people are and voters are talking about, does that help them next year, do you think?
It really depends. I mean, the Obamacare has shifted politically from people hating it at one point to really, I mean, the time that Senator McCain voted no, it was increased in popularity during that standpoint, right? But we're in a different world now where costs are skyrocketing, right? And people are paying so much per month for their health insurance premium and still paying a lot for care on top of it, right? And so people are questioning, why do I even have health insurance? And so, you know, Republicans are saying this is the failure of Obamacare. This is a failed system that Democrats put in place and have been unwilling to modify for the past 10 years. Democrats could say Republicans aren't doing anything and they just actually want to increase your health care costs so they can, you know, pay for tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires and whatnot. So, I mean, there's equal blame on both sides, right? Nobody has actually made a real effort to reform the system and make it work and function for individuals at an affordable rate, right? And so it's going to be all about framing on either side, and there's not going to be a solution before the 2016 election.
Well, so given that, I mean, do you anticipate that healthcare will continue to be a big topic of conversation going into the midterms?
Without question. And I think it probably doesn't surprise you or the listeners that I do respectfully disagree that I think that there's equal blame on both sides. I do think that without the Obama administration, without the leadership of Democrats in Congress, those 24 million Americans would not be worrying about their subsidies. They'd be worrying about healthcare, period, because the Republicans for those 10 years have been trying to get rid of Obamacare, getting rid of the Affordable Care Act wholesale from there. So Democrats have always led on responsible healthcare choices, and I think that voters are going to see that. I think the other thing that I wanted to just key in a little bit from what we were talking about earlier, I don't think it's the Democratic Party or the Democratic electeds that are necessarily going to be talking about affordability. It's going to be the voters. That's what voters really responded to last Tuesday night across the country in those those elections. So I think the juxtaposition of a president building a $300 million ballroom and having a great Gatsby party while the government shut down is a really interesting split screen when voters only want to make sure that grocery prices are actually low, not just having a president lie to them about grocery prices staying low.
All right. Guys, I want to just ask one more thing about the shutdown and the reopening before we move on from that. And Lorna, let me start with you. I'm curious, you know, SNAP, the food stamp program, got so much attention. Is this the kind of issue that people will continue to remember and think about? I guess the shutdown, maybe broadly, is this still on voters' minds leading into next year?
I don't think the shutdown as a whole will be top of voter minds. I think setting aside like the healthcare issue that we talked about, yes, because that's going to continue to reverberate going into 2016 and whatnot. I do think we've talked about this many times on the show about plenty of issues. Voters have short memories, right? And so we're going into the holidays, we're going to go into a new year, and who knows what we're going to be talking about in D.C. at that point, right? And it's not going to be a federal shutdown unless for some reason we find ourselves in this situation again leading up to the 2016 election. So I do think it was the headlines for the past few weeks. They reached their deal. People are going to move on.
Sam, what do you think?
I think the same thing, although I think what I really do appreciate is the attention that some of these essential programs received over the course of the last few weeks, because these are truly essential programs for broad, broad cross sections of our neighbors. And we just really don't get to see them as visible pieces of the fabric of our community. So to understand, even if we as individuals don't receive SNAP benefits, how integral those things are and how integral they are to our economies. Our grocery store ecosystem would look a lot different if they didn't have the reliability of that SNAP program building them up. So I think that extra attention on some of these programs was really positive. But to Lorna's point, I mean, in the age of social media and TikToks, I mean, you know, we're all moving on and we do this work. So you know, the average voter, you know, is well beyond what already happened 72 hours ago.
Yeah, the attention span is very short these days.
Be the goldfish, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What Ted Lasso said. Sam, let me stick with you on the Colorado River. This week, there was a deadline for the seven basin states to come to an agreement, a federally imposed deadline to figure out what to do with the river, which has less water in it now than when the last set of rules were implemented. The states did not come to an agreement. The Fed said, we'll give you a little more time. Meanwhile, Governor Hobbs is asking the federal government seemingly to step in and mandate rules, which the conventional wisdom is the states don't want that.
Yeah, I think that to a certain extent, though, you know, conventional wisdom is what got us to where we're at right now. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, these decades of hemming and hawing have led us to a really pivotal point about the future, not just of Arizona, but of the entire Southwest. And I think because of the increased attention and focus on the economic development and the advanced manufacturing, like hyper focus that we have in this area, this is the nation's problem. So kudos to Governor Hobbs and her team for making this a national focus, because it really should be. And this is a river that we depended on very differently 30 years ago mm-hmm. than we do now. We are no longer a red tile roof economy. And to be successful for the next 30 years, we need bold and visionary leadership. And I'm not necessarily talking about heroes. We're not looking for heroes. We're looking for leaders who can actually tell us the truth and really kind of set some four corners and some hard edges on what an agreement looks like. And there is a lot of posturing from the upper basin, which is the other states, because they kind of quote unquote get the water first, right? But I think that we really have an opportunity to position Arizona as a leader in water discussions, because we were back in 1980 and you know times since. So I think this is the moment that we really have to reorganize the power structure when it comes to the Colorado River.
And Lorna, interestingly, when Governor Hobbs sent her letter to the Interior Secretary, it was also signed by the four legislative leaders, the mm-hmm. House Speaker, House Minority Leader, Senate President, Senate Minority Leader. It seems as though maybe at least in this respect, water, at least as it relates to the Colorado River, is it becoming sort of a bipartisan issue where Arizona is sticking together once again?
Yeah, and Arizona, like Sam mentioned, obviously we differ greatly from the other basin states, right? And the way that our economy is structured and the things that we've done from a leadership standpoint to conserve water and actually prepare for a drier future. future, right? We see it every day. We live in a desert. We've been in a drought my entire life living here, you know, so we know what the reality is. And it's different than Colorado and some of the other upper basin states. Historically, water policy has been a very bipartisan issue in Arizona because Republicans and Democrats understand what's at risk. And we need that unity in order to be able to advocate for Arizona against these other states as well, right? Yes, there's some minor issues in the legislature where there are some, you know, partisan issues or even a rural and urban divide. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the river and negotiations, we've always approached it in a very bipartisan manner and making sure that all leaders are included and at the table. So I think that's very important. Kudos to Governor Hobbs for being very vocal about Arizona and taking a stand because, as Sam mentioned, our economy has shifted. There's been significant growth in Arizona, and so our needs need to be recognized and prioritized from a national standpoint. Obviously, conversations and negotiations are ongoing, right? But this is an opportunity where we need to be able to couple what's going on with the Colorado River, and then also what does the future look like and what investments do we need to be making and the forethought we need to start having in order to maintain our precious resource of water and make sure that we can keep our economy going.
So we spoke with Ted Cook, who was the former ran the Central Arizona Project. He was, of course, President Trump's nominee to lead the Bureau of Reclamation before he withdrew, mostly, we think, because the Upper Basin states weren't thrilled mm-hmm. with somebody with Arizona ties being in that role. He didn't seem terribly optimistic that the states would be able to come up with a deal on their own. Sam, do you think that the states can, or are the feds going to have to step in and do it?
Well, I'm not sure it's a can or should question, although I appreciate that framing. I think that what you see from Governor Hobbs and some other leaders in these water conversations is that perhaps there's space for someone who doesn't have a biased or vested interest to convene kind of a brokered conversation.
A mediation
kind
of thing?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, some of the mercurial attitudes of the principle aside, I think the Trump administration is perhaps one of the right conveners of that conversation, because as you even alluded to, you know, Mr. Cook withdrew his own nomination largely because the Upper Basin didn't want it. Rumored, right? Allegedly,
yeah, right?
But that type of petty bickering does not, you know, foretell, the opportunity to have bold and really important conversations around the next 30 years of the Colorado River.
Do you think that's a reasonable solution, Lorna, that maybe the feds don't say, okay, here's how it's going to be, but the feds get everybody in the room and say, come on, guys, let's figure this out, and we will help?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be the wise next step. Obviously, tensions are high. I mean, we always say this in Arizona, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, right? And so this is a very important issue for the states that are involved. And so having some type of mediator that, as Sam mentioned, doesn't have, you know, skin in the game but can look at it from more of a holistic standpoint makes sense. Anything that's going to be like a top-down approach from D.C. is not going to be helpful and is not going to work because, again, every state is different and impacted differently. And the leadership and the actions taken by every state has been different. Again, I say Arizona has done phenomenal work over the past 30 years and it's going to continue to do great work. And it's unfair to be punished when other states aren't actually living up to that same standard. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. I am more optimistic. I mean, I think, you know, cooler heads will prevail. But if D.C. actually wants to be helpful in this context, I welcome it. But that doesn't always happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just as a real quick wrap up, I'd say the other related part of this conversation is the infrastructure around water. We really absolutely need to talk about the next set of dams and the next set of water treatment and, you know, desalination and some of these really emerging, really great technologies. That takes big thinking and big investment.
All right. Sam Richard, Lorna Romero-Ferguson, thanks you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.